Today on Vox Talks Economics, Piketty on inequality. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Center for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips, and every week we bring you the best new research in economics. So remember to subscribe and follow us on Instagram as well. After a couple of years, economics conferences are back. And as you can hear in the background, this summer, Vox Talks will bring you a series of interviews from CEPR's Paris Symposium. We're going to start with the opening keynote when Thomas Piketty of the Paris School of Economics published Capital in the 21st Century. It kickstarted a reevaluation of the forces that cause inequality and the policies, of course, that we need to deal with it. The foreword to his new book promises a new perspective on the history of inequality. So when he's finished giving his keynote, I'm going to ask him what that perspective is. Thomas, why is this book called A Brief History of Equality when your work over the past 10 years has made people just very aware of inequality?
Well, because I also want people to be aware of the fact that, you know, in the long run, there is actually a long run movement toward more equality. You know, if you take a very long run perspective, so, you know, starting at the end of the 18th century with the French Revolution, the abolition of the tax privileges of the aristocracy until today, you know, you compare in the 19th century, in the 20th century, you have actually in the long run more political equality, more economic equality, more social equality. Now, it did not happen just like this. You know, it happens through major political mobilization, social struggles, and most importantly, constructive transformation of institutions through a different fiscal system, a different educational system. You know, I know we live in a period of time where people are sometimes, you know, very depressed about the present day, which I can understand. But I wanted in this book to offer, you know, this optimistic long-run perspective with a key message, with it that we could and we should continue in this direction, bringing at the same time more equality and more prosperity, because this came together historically.
It's so short. Did you feel you weren't reaching a group of people that you wanted to reach? And how did you work out what to leave out?
Well, you know, I wrote three big books, each 1,000 pages long over the past 20 years. And especially, you know, the last one, Capital and Ideology, it was 50% longer than Capital in the 21st Century, which was already very long.
That was long.
And I thought, okay, you've gone too far. You know, I have learned a lot also by writing these big books. You know, I had to do lots of research. I used lots of work by, you know, other social scientists. But, you know, at some point, you have to try to be shorter. And, you know, I had this request by many people, and I tried to be more concise to get to, you know, what's really the most important message. And I have come also not only with a shorter book, but also with a more optimistic book, because again, you know, in the end, the biggest long-run message is this long-run movement toward more equality. There's also some new stuff in my brief history of equality, more on racial inequality, you know, the legacy of colonialism, slavery, reparation, gender inequality, environmental inequality. So, you know, I have also rebalanced a little bit the focus from the previous books that put more emphasis on inequality of income and wealth, which is still there in this new book, but which I take a broader sort of multi-dimensional perspective on social inequality.
You write that inequality is a social, historical, political construction. So what's the role for economics, economists in all of this? Do we just count up the numbers?
Yeah, well, you know, it can be important to count the numbers, but let me first say that, you know, I don't view myself simply as an economist. I view myself more as a social scientist. You know, I think the boundaries between economics, history, sociology, political science are much less clear than what they should be. And I think it's a mistake for economists to imagine that they have built a science that is so scientific that it had to move away from the social sciences. I think we know very little in economics. We know very little in the social sciences in general. And so we have to be very pragmatic and, you know, spend less time about methodological quarrels, etc., and be more pragmatic, you know, collecting historical data in order to make, you know, simple comparison between countries across time period. You know, that's the best we can do. And we will never get everybody to agree about the conclusion about what we should do in the future. In the social sciences, we are not in exact sciences, but at least we can, in this way, contribute to more informed discussion. The basic lesson from history and from taking this long run perspective on economic issues is that there are always alternatives. When you look at the past, you find lots of instances where you have crises with the public debt, crises with inequality, crises with education, crises with the tax system, you know, at the time of the French Revolution already. And what you learn from these experiences is that, you know, there are different possible choices. There are different possible ways to get rid of a large public debt. None of which is easy, by the way. But at least, you know, the idea that there's only one solution and one economic policy to solve this problem is simply factually wrong on the face of history. And so opening up the history book is also a way to open up the discussion for the future.
You are very clear this is an optimistic book. In the long run, we are becoming more equal. And a lot of economists attribute that to the emergence of institutions, things like education and democracy. And they consider this a kind of endpoint. But you write that these are a precarious and unstable and temporary compromise. What do you mean by this?
Well, what I mean by that, if we take the example of democracy, so as compared to the situation where the aristocracy had political and fiscal privileges, you know, before the French Revolution, of course, we live in a time which is of almost perfect democracy. But at the same time, I think the power of money, for instance, you know, in our political system is still much bigger than what it should be. So these are not the privileges of the 18th century, but you still have very unequal voice, very unequal political participation, because if you can finance the political campaign with a huge gift, you know, you have a different political voice. If you can pay the media, if you can pay a think tank. And I think maybe 50 years from now or 100 years from now, when we have designed a better system, with, for instance, equal democratic vouchers where each individual could finance the party or candidate of his or her choice with the same amount. Same thing for the media. If and when we have designed this kind of system, maybe we will look at the democracy of today as, you know, something intermediate between 19th century property-based democracy where only the wealthiest individual had the right to vote and real democracy. So in education, this is the same. You know, what I've tried to show in my research is that today's education system is much less elitist than a century ago. It's much less elitist than in colonial empires where, as I have shown, you know, 80% of total education spending will go to the 10% of the children who happen to be the children of European settlers. In the case of French Algeria, it was just as bad or even worse than in the south of the United States with a fully segregated school system. So, you know, as compared to this, or even as compared to educational inequality in England in 1900 or in France in 1900, let alone the colonial empires, today's distribution of educational resources is vastly more equal. And still, it is very unequal in the sense that the probability to access higher education is very much determined by your parental income, and the kind of higher education you go to is not the same depending on your parental income. And we should set ambitious targets, because what's at stake is not only equality of opportunity, which, you know, is a theoretical concept that people pretend they are attached to, but when we try to make it more concrete in terms of access to well-funded higher education, access to minimum inheritance for all, you know, which should be the basis of equal opportunity, then people, especially people from the top, they find all sorts of good reason to explain that this is not so good. And so, yes, the fight toward equality in education, in political participation, in voice, in economic democracy, so it's participation to decision-making not only in political elections, but also in decision-making in companies, this long-run movement is clearly not over yet.
In your presentation, several times you asked, can we do better? I think of a group that thought that we can do better several years ago out on the streets, just outside here, the Gilets Jaunes. Was their protest against inequality, in your view?
Well, in some sense, you know, their protest was against inequality. The problem is that in terms of constructive platform, they didn't have the proposal to transform their protest into a positive movement. But let me make clear that their protest was in many ways justified. What happened in France in 2018 is the caricature of what should not be done in terms of carbon taxation and environmental policy. What happened was that there was a big increase in the carbon tax, and the tax revenue were used to a large extent to pay for the repeal of the wealth tax benefiting the top 1% of the population. It was basically the same kind of money, you know, between 5 and 10 billion euro in extra carbon tax that was going to be paid over 2 years in 2018, 2019, and roughly the same money that was going out of the state budget to pay for the repeal of the wealth tax and the progressive tax on top capital income. And so, you know, the government was saying, oh, we're increasing the carbon tax for the environment, and this is for the sake of the planet. But at the same time, they were going on TV saying, oh, we're going to use the money to cut the wealth tax. And so people went mad. And so the lesson from this is twofold. First, if you want to have carbon taxation, you know, 100% of the revenue should go to the environment, investment in public infrastructure, transportation, compensation for the less well-off. But I think the second lesson is even bigger than that, which is that we need some kind of progressive carbon taxation. You cannot treat in the same manner someone who has a carbon emission of 3 or 4 or 5 tons, which is the average carbon emission of the bottom 50% of the population in France or in Europe right now, and people who have carbon emission of 20, 30, 40 tons, which is the kind of average emission of the top 10% in France or in Europe right now. If we don't invent some system to deal with them in a different manner, and if we want to reduce proportionally all carbon emission in the same rate, I think we're going to have a gigantic yellow vest movement, not only in France, but pretty much everywhere, all across Europe and all across the world.
Well, all across the world, when we make policy on a lot of things, on education, taxation, we often think about the impact on inequality afterwards. We evaluate that afterwards. How do we ensure that that conversation happens at the time the policies are being considered? Who does that?
Well, that's why I'm very skeptical about sort of ex post compensation. I think it needs to be built in the policy right away. And that's why it needs to take the form of directly progressive carbon taxation, in the sense that, you know, the first quantity of consumption of energy or the first tons of carbon emission should be tax exempt or very small tax rate, so that you don't pay to begin with. Because the idea, okay, you're first going to pay, but then you will be compensated later. This creates some uncertainty, some ambiguity, sometimes for very good reason, and that's not going to work. That's why we need to move to a different kind of system with explicitly graduated tax rate for energy consumption. I know this requires some institutional innovation, but, you know, it was the same when the modern progressive income tax was set up a century ago. Some people then said, this is impossible, this is going to be intrusive, inquisitorial, you cannot do that. Well, okay, you know, we did it. So, you know, the question is, are we serious about solving the problem we have to solve?
His new book is called A Brief History of Equality and is published by Belknap Press. This has been a Vox Talk recorded live at CEPR Paris Symposium 2022. Every week we bring you the most important latest research, so subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And when you subscribe, you'll find more than 200 episodes. Whatever type of economics you like, there is a Vox Talk waiting for you.